Almost all this psalm is in the second person, by which I mean it's addressed you, you, your. And so that shapes the way I've set it out. So I'm going to preach it in three parts. So verses 1 to 4, David addresses, should we call him Doeg? You happy with that? Not Doug. We'll go for Doeg. It's tempting just to call him Doug, but I don't, that's probably not going to be helpful. Verses 1 to 4, he addresses Doeg, the Edomite. This is what you are. Verses 5 to 7, David addresses Doeg, the Edomite. This is what the Lord will do with you. So 1 to 4, this is what you are, Doeg. 5 to 7, this is what the Lord will do to you, Doeg. And verses 8 to 9, the camera then is on the Lord himself. And David addresses the Lord, says, you are worthy of all praise and you are good. You are good. So, Doeg, this is what you are. Doeg, this is what the Lord will do. And Lord, you're worthy of praise and you are good. Okay, I thought we'd start with a little game. It's called Guess the Book. I'm going to read the first few lines of the book, see if you know it. It was the best of times. It was the worst of times. Oh, very good. I was going to carry on. It was the age of wisdom. It was the age of foolishness. You haven't given me the book title yet, though. It is Dickens. No. It was the epoch of belief. It was the epoch of incredulity. Teller Two Cities, 1859. Now, you might wonder why I've started with that game. I think it's just to point out the contrast. And here in Psalm 52, David sets out some really clear contrasts. You have Doeg the Edomite, Saul's chief of shepherds, on the one hand, and David himself, once a shepherd boy, and now the anointed successor. In other circumstances, it might have been David who would have risen to chief of shepherds, Saul's strongman. But David's position under Saul hasn't stayed so rosy. In fact, it's so deteriorated since that song about David killing the thousands that Saul so didn't like, just the song, seeing the effect it had, that David is now the enemy of the king. He's wanted dead by King Saul. And look who's in his place. The chief of shepherds is now a foreigner. And there is Doeg on Saul's team against David. And Doeg's quite happy to go along with this aim of destroying David. And no doubt for Doeg, it's his way of pushing David down and raising himself up as Saul's mighty man. So I'm going to give us some context about why David felt the need to write this psalm. I don't know how much you remember. We did 1 Samuel not so long ago. But for those who perhaps missed it or weren't there, we're going to go through a little bit of 1 Samuel 21 and 22. That's really why David wrote this. Now, Doeg has somehow ended up working for King Saul. He's not a Jew, but we know that there were some battles between the Edomites and the Israelites, and it would look as though Doeg's come as a kind of prisoner of war and has ended up as this tough man working for King Saul. And Doeg's made his allegiances clear. He is making it as clear as he could possibly make it that he's on Saul's team. And he's going to prove this to everyone. Doeg, though, is a bloodthirsty man out for his own gain. And he stands firmly, he believes, to gain from siding with Saul. Who knows, maybe his eyes are even on the kingdom itself. David, meanwhile, is no stranger to deceit. David's on the loose, travelling wild through the valleys and nearby kingdoms, looking for some kind of refuge in order to avoid the malicious intent of King Saul, who's out to kill him. And this psalm is all about lies and deceit, and yet David's no stranger to lies and deceit. He's quite happy to lie if it suits him. It's not so long, I think it's 1 Samuel 23, and David is pretending to be mad in order to fool the king of Achish. No deceit's above David in his aim to try and find his own protection and cover. And it's in this kind of desperation of avoiding being killed by Saul that he seeks out in the city of Nob, the priests. And in fact, it's the priest Ahimelech, to be precise. And David goes to him seeking blessing. He wants some food as well, and a weapon. And it's the very sword that he's provided with, which he killed Goliath. But if you look at 1 Samuel 21, and this meeting with David and priest Ahimelech, David just lies. He says something like this. He says, "Oh, I've come on urgent business from the king," as in King Saul. Well, that's not true. He says in 1 Samuel 21, verse 8, "I was in such a hurry, for the king's business was urgent. And I was in such a hurry, I forgot to bring a weapon. So if you could provide me a weapon, that would be brilliant." Well, this is a pretense. Not a word of it's true. And this whole meeting between the priest and David sets out the beginning of our psalm. So if you look at the beginning of Psalm 52, the little parts in italics, it says, "Well, for the director of music, a maskil of David, when Doeg the Edomite had gone to Saul and told him, David has gone to the house of Ahimelech," meaning David was there chatting to the priest, asked for the sword and asked for the bread. He even said he was there on King Saul's business. Well, Doeg must have seen in David a man after his own heart. He was a man willing to lie for his own safety and gain. How Doeg must have chuckled to himself as he heard David explain that he was on the king's business. Doeg knew full well that the king's current business at that point was to kill David, not to send David anywhere else to look for different things. Now, why should Doeg have been a knob at that time? Not quite sure, but we are told that he was detained before the Lord. Now, we can be pretty certain that Doeg wasn't there for good behaviour, nor was he there to seek blessing from amongst the priests. This is Saul's chief shepherd, the strong man. So a nice way of imagining this is picture a mafia boss. I don't know if you've watched many of these films, but the mafia boss wants to keep his hands clean. He doesn't want to do the dirty work himself. So he has a hitman to do the killing, an assassin. And here comes Doeg. Doeg's the assassin who does the dirty work. He wasn't in Nob looking for repentance. More likely it was some form of ancient day asbo, with no doubt a curfew enforced upon him. He had to be there at this certain time. He didn't want to be there. It wasn't something he'd chosen to do or be in. And so it was that Doeg was in some sense in the hands and kind of the trust of the priests. And that's why he came to be this witness between David and Ahimelech. There was some kind of trust that Saul had placed in there as a kind of, this is where you have to be for now. But Doeg has no respect for these priests. What trust there was between him and the priests is soon to be obliterated. And so when Doeg witnesses the conversation between David and Ahimelech, he carefully stores it up, kind of ponders on it, think, I'll keep that for an opportune time. I'll store that up. I'll remember that. And it's not long before he passes that on, just at the right time. David, meanwhile, continues to roam the area. He's seeking refuge. He's impersonating a madman. He's hiding in caves, herding together other rabble-rousers, even becoming their leader. And Saul, we're told in 1 Samuel 22, wants to know where David is. So picture the scene. Saul is on a hill. We're told it's the hill of Gibeah. He sat while all his men are stood around him. We're told he sat under a tamarisk tree. I looked it up. It's just a tree. It's nothing that exciting. A tamarisk tree, with all his officials stood around him. So top of the mountain, Saul sat there. Saul sat there with his spear in his hand, with his men stood around him. And he complains to these men about David. He says, "God, what's David ever done for you? What's he going to do for you? I'm your king." And it just so happens that among the officials is Doeg, the strong man. And he thinks, now's the moment to pass on this little bit of information about David. I'm just going to slip it in there. So in verse 9 of 1 Samuel 22, He tells the truth. He passes on. He says, oh, I saw, well, let's find out, actually. I saw David with Ahimelech the priest. So it says in 1 Samuel 22, but Doeg the Edomite, who was standing with Saul's official, said, I saw the son of Jesse, that's David, come to Ahimelech, son of Hittiab, at Nob. Ahimelech inquired of the Lord for him. He also gave him provisions and the sword of Goliath, the Philistine. And straight away, King Saul's mind's made up. He calls for Ahimelech. And it's not going to go very well for the priest from that moment on. Yet behind the words of Doeg, as he slips in those little words of what he saw, there is venomous intent. He knows what he's doing. And we're told, or David describes it, as the sharpening of a razor blade. Doeg's words are going to end up with slaughter. So that's a little bit of context to bring you into the psalm. Doeg's sharing a little gossip he heard or saw. And as I said earlier, it's like those tasty morsels of Proverbs 18. They go down into the innermost part of Saul's body. He hears that gossip. It might be true, but it's gossip nonetheless. And it's gone down into Saul's innermost part. And Saul won't hesitate in his heart what he's got to do. As soon as he hears, he's decided. Now, I remember Phil Hare last weekend was talking about how information is processed in the mind and then it affects our hearts before it goes to the will, before we decide. And those three stages, head, heart and will, are like that for King Saul. There's no hanging about for him. He knows what he's going to do. So verses 1-4, first point, although we've kind of gone into it already. This is what you are, Doeg. And David aims his words in this psalm with precision. You who practice deceit, your tongue plots destruction. And that's what Doeg's tongue's doing. It's plotting destruction here. And the deceit here is the betrayal of trust between Doeg and the priests. Doeg, who was detained before the Lord and in the service of Saul, was in a position of trust. But it's not a position Doeg intended to honour. His betrayal of the priest is a little bit like this. Imagine it's World War II and you have someone who's hiding some Jews in Germany, let's say. And he's agreed to hide the Jews. There's that kind of trust between the person who's hiding the Jews. But when the Germans come up to his house and say, are there any Jews here? He points exactly to the place where they're hidden. Is that telling the truth? Yes. Would it be betraying a loyalty? Definitely. Would you be responsible for their death? Without doubt. And here's the position of Doeg. He doesn't only just betray the priests, he joins in with the slaughter, with bloodthirsty relish. And that's why David is writing this psalm. How dare you? How dare you do this, Doeg? How dare you think you can come into our country and side with the king and do this? This is disgusting. This is a disgrace, which is the word used in this psalm. Another analogy I thought was, it's a bit like telling the school bully. You probably can remember the biggest school bully when you were at school. And telling that school bully that someone he doesn't like has done something or said something awful to him or about his family. And then you just walk away. And you watch the scene unfold as the bully exacts his judgment. That's what Doeg's done. Well, Saul, who's our bully here, doesn't take long to declare death upon the priest, Ahimelech. He says in verse 16 of 1 Samuel 22, you'll surely die, Ahimelech. I think he's decided already, hadn't he? You and your father's whole family. Saul has gone mad in his bloodthirsty rage. And as for Doeg, he loves it. Saul commands his officials to strike the priests of the Lord, but they don't. they fear God. For they knew by instinct that killing a priest was a disgraceful thing to do. Yet Doeg has no such inhibitions. His instincts have not been formed in a home that honours and fears God. Doeg's instincts were formed in an Edomite home that cared not for God at all. Doeg's ready to fight. Here's the strong man doing the king's business. And that day he and Saul killed 85 men who wore the linen ephod, we're told. Moreover, he puts the whole city of Nob to the sword with its priests, men and women, children and infants, and its cattle, donkeys and sheep. There's no stopping this man, Doeg. He's a man intent on blood. It's no wonder David felt this man was worthy of a psalm. And it really is a psalm of attack. It's like bullet, 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 bullet. Doeg, this is what you are. This is what you are. So let's stand back and consider what just happened. Saul, with the help of a foreigner, murders the priests of Nob. 85 of them, and all the city. There's something back to front going on here. Saul should be protecting his priests from foreign attacks. That makes sense. Saul was the king of Israel. Here are his priests, honouring the Lord, taking the sacrifices, doing their job. Foreigners come in and attack. Saul should be defending his people. That makes sense, doesn't it? Yet what's happening? Because things have gone topsy-turvy, upside down. Instead of protecting his priests from the attacker, the foreigner, Saul is on the side of the foreigner, joining in the attack of his own priests, slaughtering them. Right and wrong have been reversed. This is worse than the people of Israel could possibly have feared when they told God they wanted a king like the other nations. Remember, we want a king just like the other nations. Instead of a king like the other nations, it's like they have a king from the other nations, one ready to come and attack them. Here's a king who slaughters the priests of Israel. You wouldn't think it was an Israelite king. In fact, who needs to fear the foreign kings when your own king does this? This slaughter is reminiscent of King Herod in his madness and jealousy, killing all the members of his own family. What should have been considered abhorrent is now just what Saul does. And in our culture too, Satan's out to reverse that's all that's right and good and warp our sense of judgment so we overlook something like this and just think, oh, that's normal. Satan must be laughing at what took place. Saul, God's king, is killing God's priests. Saul has gone mad in his rage, and there's no stopping him. And so while Psalm 52 is David's lament, we're told it's a maskil, some kind of musical term, it's aimed at Doeg, but it's also a swipe at King Saul. For the slaughter of Nob is actually described as a double act. It's Saul and Doeg together. So when David says, "Why do you boast of evil, you mighty hero?" he's not meaning that mighty hero with sincerity. He's being sarcastic. Mighty hero. These aren't words of praise. It's not saying, well, it's that put down, isn't it? Yeah, well done, big man. Killing your own priest is hardly something to be proud of. What a big man, you big guy. It's like the sarcastic applause for a man who beats up his wife. Well done, how brave and noble of you, well done. So a defenseless group of priests are slaughtered. You might think much of yourself, Doeg, but in the eyes of God, you're a disgrace. You, who in your own eyes are up here, are in God's eyes down here. And God is the one who sees all things and will call all men and women to account. So we too need to be careful of our estimation of ourselves. That's why the New Testament says, view yourselves with sober judgment. We must avoid such a gross miscalculation of who we are. There's only one truth here. Saul and Doeg are a disgrace in the eyes of God, whose eyes are the only ones that matter. Saul's men, that is the officials who refused to attack the priest, they knew it all along. To kill God's priest was nothing to be proud of, but an act of self-defeat, a scandalous, foolish, and insane act of self-retribution, ultimately against self. And it's no wonder that it's a foreigner who has no sense of the fear of God who's the one to take Saul's words of violence and obey. David says, you practice deceit. Your tongue plots destruction like a sharpened razor. And David knows this violence was set up by Doeg. Doeg, who slipped in the latest news, that gossip of David's meeting with Ahimelech, and then just waits for the killing to start. Saul is like a tool in his hands. You love evil rather than good. This is who you are and what you are. You love falsehood rather than the truth, you deceitful tongue. Now, there is some irony here, though, that we can't ignore. David in this event is hardly an example of true speech. When he met Ahimelech, he wasn't exactly telling the truth. And by entangling the priests with his own misadventure, David is partly linked to their demise. What is clear, though, is we must take note of the warning in this passage for us. Lies and deceit cause destruction. We must never treat the truth as something light or disposable, something we can just shift or change. We must honour what's true and hate what's false. And if you do a study of all the Psalms, this theme is just recurring all the time. We must cleave to what's true and be known for it. So this means that we must say, out with white lies, with little lies that aren't quite the truth. To even use a phrase like that shows we're not taking it seriously. Out with exaggerating for effect. Out with inaccuracies that paint a picture that suits us. Out with bad memory, because actually to remember it clearly wouldn't paint us in a good light. You know the ones where like, oh, I can't really remember. Because you know that if you had remembered it well, it wouldn't look too good for you. In with striving to be honest in every area, filling in forms accurately, even if it doesn't suit our pockets. In with confessing our sins to the Lord. In with being accurate and precise with the truth. Weighing each word we give. Psalm 141 talks of setting a guard over our mouths. And we must also take Jesus' word seriously, that we'll be held accountable for every careless word that comes from our mouths. I think I said earlier, James talks in the New Testament of our tongues. It's like they start little fires. And if we look back over our, maybe just this week or our lives, we can certainly mourn our own shortcomings. The times when we know we've said things we wish we hadn't. Scripture is clear. Lying causes damage. It's never okay. Must never be overlooked. You probably know those cigarette packets. Well, some of you might. The ones that, they're quite blunt now, aren't they? I think years ago they used to be fairly more sort of gentle. Now they just say things like smoking kills. It's not very subtle. Smoking kills. And that's what you see on cigarette packets. And this psalm tells us something similar. Lying kills. You might think, come on, that's a bit silly. You're being a bit over the top, aren't you? But just as smoking doesn't kill immediately, so lying has an insidious way of working through someone's heart, working through their mind and soul. And we talk of lies leading to more lies and more lies. And as parents, we've got to be hot on this. We cannot let children think, or we cannot think ourselves, oh, they'll grow out of it, or it's just a little lie. And I remember once somebody saying, and they were reflecting on their own life, and they said, never let your children lie. Never let your children lie. It ends up causing damage. And lies ruin our ability to see the truth clearly. Lies distort our view of God. And we know Satan's other name, don't we? He's the father of lies. And we all need God's help to take this more seriously. So perhaps in this psalm, David is also seeing his own role here partly and saying, well, actually, I know I've fallen short here. And he's mourning his own sin. Either way, God's judgment's soon to come. So let's look at verses 5 to 7 of Psalm 52. God acts. So we looked at, on the first point, Doeg, this is who you are, this is what you are. Second point, Doeg, this is what the Lord will do to you. Let's look at verse 5 first. Surely God will bring you down to everlasting ruin. He'll snatch you up and pluck you from your tent. He'll uproot you from the land of the living. Justice is going to be handed out. Your life's not in your own hands, but in the hands of God. If you look in the if you look at the verbs in verse 5, they're all done by God. It's God's hand doing everything in Doeg's life, isn't it? Doeg thinks his life's his, like most people, isn't it? We think we control our lives. We think we do things in our lives. We control it. But this verse says, no, actually, everything in your life is in the hand of God. So the verbs are there. God will bring you down to everlasting ruin. God will snatch you up and pluck you from your tent. He will uproot you from the land of the living. Every part of the judgment is God's doing. So it's as though the Lord with his hand picks up this man, drags him down, snatches him up, plucking him and uprooting him eternally. So the life of Doeg and Saul, in fact all of us, rests in the hands of God. We all live at his mercy. Our lives aren't acted out as we might imagine, with us the main actor. The director of our life is God himself. And to live in the fear of God, who alone directs our lives, is the only right and wise way to live. There's a total justice here too. The ruin for Doeg's everlasting. There's no way back. Justice is complete. And the land of the living will have no place for the one God judges. If you look at verses 6 and 7, you can see he's watching. There's a witness to all this. Slightly ironic, isn't it? Because Doeg was the witness for David and Ahimelech. And now there's other witnesses. The righteous will see and fear. They will laugh at you, saying, here now is the man who did not make God his stronghold, but trusted in his great wealth and grew strong by destroying others. Not only is the judgment exact and right, but it will be witnessed and seen by others. While Doeg is the casual witness of David's meeting with the priest, there'll be many who witness Doeg's end. And they'll laugh with scorn. Doeg will become an object of ridicule. The tough man, the strong man, will now be laughed at. The righteous will see and fear. But this isn't a fear of man, but a right fear of God that should reside in all our hearts. The fear of God's the beginning of wisdom, say the Psalms. And so, to be a witness of what would come of Doeg would sober up anyone. This should encourage us to take note. Do we take lessons from things we observe in life? Do we see ourselves as observers and learners from what we see and observe? If events we witness turn our hearts to a right fear of God, we can count them as blessings. It's the righteous that look on life and learn to fear God. And it would appear that such a lesson is lost on the unrighteous. To have a right fear of God is to view life with wisdom. And yet so much of modern life leaves people not with a fear of God, but an ignorance of him or flippancy with anything godly, as though he were irrelevant. David quotes the observer who sees the end of Doeg. So with a wry laugh, that kind of laughing as they say it. Here now is the man who did not make God his stronghold, trusted in his great wealth instead and grew strong by destroying others. It's kind of a shaking your head laugh. So a commentator said, laughter is the devastating penalty for the high and mighty. Total disgrace is the end for Doeg. And Doeg, this man, he had these two choices of where to put his trust. Like we all do, these two choices. It's really interesting, isn't it? It's exactly what Jesus says in the New Testament. You'll either serve God or you serve money. Doeg's choice was money. So do I trust money or God? Can't trust them both, Jesus tells us. You have to make a choice. And to trust in money is a refusal to lean on God. No doubt being chief of shepherds in those days meant lots of sheep. and lots of money and status in the eyes of ancient day Israel. And Doeg must, you know, he's come from nothing. He's come from being some kind of slave prisoner. And look how he's risen. He's gone the opposite ways of David. David was their kind of shepherd boy hero and ends up being hated and wanted to be killed, despite the fact he's done no wrong. So Ahimelech even argues with Saul later, well, David's your greatest man. He's done you no wrong. And there's this insidious outsider, Doeg, who comes along, a prisoner, and in the place of David seems to kind of go the other way. No doubt accumulating much money on the way. Doeg sides with Saul. He thinks that's the way to go. Prestige and wealth over wisdom and the ways of the Lord. Violence over peace. Evil over good. And we've got our own choices to make when it comes to money. That danger that's talked about so much more than anything else really by Jesus. What grip does money have over our lives? Do we hold on to it lightly or too tightly? Where's our trust? And how do we make God our stronghold? Well, we trust in him. We're honest in our dealings. Even when some deception might, on the face of it, benefit us. Even when it's a deception we have no one else we need to know about. We do what's right. And if you go back a couple of Psalms, you look at Psalm 49, verse 6. And it's worth looking at, actually. It's really good. It speaks to those who trust in their wealth. So if you look at, I'll read it, Psalm 49, 6. Those who trust in their wealth and boast of their great riches. And you look at the verse before and you think, I wonder why they got so wealthy. And the ESV gives the words, basically says they're cheats. They're cheats. And in the verse there it says they're deceivers. The reason they've made that much money and they boast in their wealth is because they've been dishonest with money. That's part of trusting in money. You're dishonest. You're not straight with money. Here's a clear sign one trusts in money and not the Lord. Are we honest to our own hurt? Another way we make God our stronghold is we don't push others down to boost ourselves. We're content with the place God has given us in life. So Doeg thought like this. He thought, if I push others down, it has a kind of ricochet effect on me like this. You kind of push others down, I'm going to go up. That's how Doeg saw life. With power, in wealth, in position, and yet not in the estimation of God. In fact, God sides against those who crush the weak and helpless. And God views Doeg as a disgrace, someone he has set his face against. So in contrast, we're to support and defend the weak, side with the afflicted, even when there's no obvious benefit to ourselves. So final point and to end with. And now the camera zooms off Doeg and focuses in upon the Lord. So verses 8 and 9. Again, the second person, but this time it's not Doeg. The you and the your is the Lord. You're worthy of all praise and you're good. It would appear at first that David makes the contrast with himself. He talks of Doeg and now he talks about himself. He says, I am like an olive tree flourishing in the house of God. I trust in God's unfailing love forever and ever, and that's right. But really the focus doesn't end up on David, our weak and unsteady man. But the focus instead is on the God he worships. And David ends this psalm worshipping and praising the Lord. That's where the future is. That's where eternity is. Doeg's going to be uprooted and gone. The Lord will reign forever. In fact, by the end, Doeg's forgotten. There's a commentator called Alec Matir, and he calls this psalm, he calls it the Tale of Two Trees. And you've got this contrast of two trees. I didn't spot it at first, actually, but you've got Doeg, the tree that's snatched, torn, and uprooted from the earth, thrown out and destroyed in verse 5. And here in verse 8, David describes himself like a green olive tree in the house of God, securely placed in the Lord's presence, an evergreen with eternal security. So one tree is dead, destroyed by God. The other tree is blessed by God and growing in peace, fully alive, a life forever. Here's the man who trusts in God and his steadfast love forever and ever. And note that word forever. Verse 5, broken down forever. Verse 8, trust in God forever. So we have to take care to watch our directions. It's a warning for us, isn't it? The directions we go in will be forever directions. Our paths won't have a stop or a pause. They'll be going on for eternity. And there'll come a point where our choices in this life will be stamped as permanent. Got one life here, one chance to respond to the Lord. One chance to respond to his grace through his son Jesus, who died to redeem us. One chance before a permanent stamp forever is etched upon us. And that's it, life or death, blessing or curse. It's like Moses telling the people in Deuteronomy. Do you trust in God or not? Are you trusting God or in money? Now, David wasn't perfect. He was culpable somewhat for the disaster with the priests, but his heart trusted in the Lord and he loved the Lord. And his praises for the Lord echo down to us through the Psalms. Here's a man who loved his God and knew the worth of his God. Verse 9 says this, "For what you have done, I will always praise you in the presence of your faithful people, and I'll hope in your name, for your name is good." First seven verses have this word you or your directed at Doeg. 14 times. It's quite a lot. It's like a finger pointing 14 times in disgust. But now David lifts his eyes up higher. And by verse 9, the second person, you, is no longer Doeg, but the Lord himself. So listen again. "For what you have done, I will always praise you in the presence of your faithful people, and I will hope in your name, for your name is good." The camera is onto the Lord alone now, on his majesty. Doeg's faded, he's being thrown out, and now center stage is the Lord in his goodness with his people, worthy of all our praise. The contrast isn't really Doeg and David, but death and life. Death without God, or life with him. Growing, praising, adoring, seeing, singing, full of thanks, gratitude that won't end. What is it that God's done? Well, God's got rid of the evil Doeg, snatched up, thrown away, and God promises to rid our world of all evil one day too, just as completely as Doeg was removed. But God's also dealt with the evil inside of us. Sin isn't just out there, other people, things on TV or the media, but sin resides in our hearts and minds, eating away, causing jealousy, envy, strife and hatred. And at the cross, Jesus, God's Son, died, an innocent life in place of us, a sacrifice, taking away the punishment of sin, the debt that we owed, taken by Jesus instead of us. Here's the promise of God to remove our sin, to view our sin as null and void, counted for by Christ's death at the cross. And if we know Jesus and have admitted our sin, our evil thoughts, our lusts, our anger, our envy, our bitterness, our lack of gratitude, then we can leave that body of death and enter a new life, not perfect yet, but one destined to live on forever. Not one cast away and plucked up, but one considered by God righteous to be forgiven. That's the way we must choose. And so David praises God for what he's done, and his praises know no end. "For what you've done, I'll always praise you." To think there's an end of praising God is, you know, like a film, like an end of a performance or end of me preaching tonight. It's to misunderstand the nature of God. There's no end of praising God. We can't quite get our heads around this eternity part. But through eternity, we'll never tire or grow bored of praising the Lord. And we'll truly see once in heaven, in ways we can't really see now, that he has no end. Eternity will take on a new meaning for us. We'll see in shades that up until that moment were unimaginable or inconceivable for us now, beyond our comprehension, something we can only distantly perceive, like a taste we can't quite grasp but have a faint inkling of. And we will, like the director's gazes now at the end of this psalm, become lost in adoration, praise and worship, fixated not any longer by God's removal of evil, though we're grateful for that, but fixated on the person of God himself, who's totally worthy of our praise and is good. We could have talked more on God's goodness, but David trusts in God's goodness. That's what he's fixated on by the end, not Doeg. And so together, the faithful praise the name of God for all he's done forever. And by then, we'll know more fully than we do now how good he is. Let's pray.